You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Washington Nationals. I'm joined by Jamal Collier, and we're heading into the year 2017. And Jamal, for my money, it might be the biggest, you know, clearest hole in the game among contending teams is the Washington Nationals' ninth inning situation. They struck out on the three principal figures in free agency, Kenley Jansen, Aroldis Chapman, and Mark Melanson. So now what, basically? What happens next?
Yeah, they're kind of going to have to get creative a little bit here. And I don't know, they're still trying to search internally to say, do we have the answer in-house? You know, can we move a guy like Sean Kelly or Blake Treinen and Coda Glover, some of the young guys they have that they really like a lot that show promise and they've got the stuff and the makeup? But it's a lot to ask on a team who is kind of in win-now mode and has, you know, high aspirations to come in a season with a guy who's never, you know, closed before. And they're trying to decide whether or not that's something they feel that they're comfortable with. If you do feel pretty good about one of those guys, potentially what you could do is beef up your seventh, eighth, and setup men guys and maybe make some trades or sign some guys in that respect, because there's not a very clear option anymore free agent-wise for as far as your closer goes. They've had to probably work out some kind of trade. They've had interest in guys like David Robertson, Alec Colome. And just some of those names you've kind of seen floated out there. But basically, there's been a free agent reliever that could potentially move. The Nats have pretty much checked in on him and see, all right, would he potentially fit with this group? But, yeah, it's you know, still late in the offseason and kind of this game of musical chairs, and the Nats right now are kind of left without a match.
Yeah, it's obviously it's become an explosive market. And we saw coming off the postseason we had where you know, relievers were such a big storyline in the postseason, which was, of course, happened before. But I think everything's kind of been to the extreme when it comes to relief side. And the Nationals dealt with that this season, the difficulty of piecing together in the ninth until they traded for Melanson. So they certainly don't want to be caught in that same situation they had in the first half. So it's going to be fascinating to see what Mike Rizzo pulls off there. The other thing we know is sometimes maybe they don't totally fall out of trees, but sometimes closers are born out of unusual situations, or a guy who's never performed that role before all of a sudden is thrust in it and performs well. So we'll see.
And just really quick on that, I mean, thinking has always kind of been is, man, that there's always – to what, 10 relievers that were kind of looking at each other halfway through the season and saying, who is this guy? And he's having a really good year. And there's just always somebody on a contending team that is trading closer somewhere midseason. So, you know, it's something that I think that, and they got used to it. They got through the first half of last season with Papelbon, who had his struggles and had his kind of worries with you. So if you can kind of get through it a little bit, usually there's somebody that can emerge to become either on the market or possibly in-house.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because you mentioned Alex Colome as you know, potential big trade candidate for the ninth inning. And a year ago at this time, he was known as who, you know, and he had a 3.94 ERA and a 1.3 whip. So I don't think he was exactly, you know, prescribed as a guy who's going to finish with 37 saves in 2016. So it's always an interesting market. Obviously, the key obvious names came off the board at significant sums, but we'll see what the future holds in that particular market. You know, another thing, Jamal, that's kind of been floated out there is kind of the opposite thing, where he wasn't a highly prized hot commodity in free agency. It was Matt Wieters, and he's still lingering out there in free agency. And the Nationals are being tied to Matt Wieters, which is, of course, interesting, given that they just traded for Derek Norris. So,
right.
And I don't know, the idea of them signing Wieters and then flipping Norris, while possible, is also, you know, pretty complicated.
A little odd.
Interesting to say the least. Yeah, a little odd to say the least. So what are your thoughts on the Wieters situation?
I think, you know, initially coming into the offseason, they had some interest in Wieters. And when you think about trying to replace the production that Wilson Ramos left, Wieters could is much easier, much closer to that number. He'll probably get you, if not, you know, somewhere similar compared to Norris. So really, what they wouldn't expect Norris to kind of put up those exact numbers with maybe a combo between him and Trey Turner's now a full season and having some Anthony Rendon in there as well. But, you know, with a guy like Wieters, he like you said, he has that offensive the power that you lost with Ramos. And I think the fact is, like we alluded to, coming into the year, they said, okay, potentially, or to the offseason, you know, they were prepared to give some money to a closer. and that didn't work out. And now they're kind of, I don't want to say, it's not like you have leftover money necessarily or extra money, but you're kind of saying, well, okay, potentially we have this XYZ potentially that we thought would be locked up. And maybe we can shift here and look and see if we use these funds somewhere else. You really didn't give up a whole lot to get Norris. So, you know, giving him and potentially getting something else could work. So I think that's a little bit maybe what the thinking is here, and that if Wieters is out there still in somewhere in January and he's kind of a valuable piece that you think it could bring in, especially if it comes at a discount, if he really doesn't have a much of a market for him, you know, perhaps they would go for that. But like I said, it's a little bit weird, a little bit odd to see exactly how all those pieces would fit and how, you know, quickly could they flip Norris. What's exactly the market for Norris if a guy like Wieters can't even find a job? So it's something to keep an eye on. And I don't think they've necessarily ruled it out, but they do like Norris. They do think he's going to be a really good bounce back candidate for this season. He can't be any worse than he was last year, at least offensively. And he's been a solid player defensively. So I think they'd be comfortable if they have to start the year with Norris, but kind of just keeping their options open a little bit.
What else is on the shopping list for the Nats here as we go into the new year? Obviously, they just traded Danny Espinosa to the Angels, so you could probably see the need for some infield bench help, I would imagine. Anything else on the horizon?
Yeah, filling out their bench is going to be something. When you lose a guy, Espinosa would have been perfect in that kind of utility role, but he was a guy who felt like he was a starter. Drew is a guy who was really vital to their bench last season, and they like him a lot. But, you know, he potentially could find somewhere to sign and maybe even get a chance to start, at least compete for a starting spot. So they're going to fill out their bench, probably with another infielder, maybe with some kind of guy. Somebody else can play the outfield, but they do have Michael Taylor and Brian Goodwin as well on their team. So you would think that, you know, they may be good on that. I think kind of just some depth things as well, just when they did make the trade for Eaton, give up a lot of with Giolito and Lopez, you don't have really any kind of insurance in case one of your starters goes down. So, you know, potentially if they make more trades like for Norris, it could be for a backup starter, for somebody that necessarily just kind of help fill out your organizational depth, and a guy could start if injuries happened in 2017. So I would look for maybe smaller moves once they figure out exactly what they want to do with the closer role.
All right. There's the latest word from Jamal Collier as we go into 2017 and the Nats look to defend their NL East title. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Washington Nationals edition. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Katchman. This is our latest look at the New York Mets. I'm joined by Anthony DiComo, and we are kind of venturing into 2017 here and thinking about what's next for the Metropolitans. And, Anthony, obviously, we know that something's coming because these guys have too many outfielders in the corners and not enough help in center field. Something's got to give here. What do you foresee for the outfield situation with Jay Bruce and Curtis Granderson on the block? Where do things stand in that market?
Well, the Mets are still trying really hard to trade Jay Bruce, and there's a very strong chance that they do, maybe even soon. This is a logjam in the outfield, and, Jay Bruce once was, when the Mets traded for him, a significant part of the Mets' 2017 plans, but he's not anymore. And so while there's been plenty of interest in trading Curtis Granderson from other teams, maybe you get a little more for Curtis Granderson than you do for Jay Bruce, who's coming off a bad second half of 2016. The Mets don't want to do that. They want to trade Jay Bruce, and when they're that committed to a cause, it's probably going to get done. They need Curtis Granderson to play center field because, there are plenty of fantasy baseball fans out there who want to trade for Andrew McCutchen or want to make some big blockbuster deal to shore this thing up in center field, it's probably not going to happen. Realistically, you're looking at Curtis Granderson in center field most days for the Mets. It's something the Mets have grown comfortable with in recent months. They played him out there down the stretch in 2016, and it worked out pretty well. 35 years old, Curtis Granderson was, and he will be 36, but he showed some athleticism. He rated pretty positively on all the metrics, and granted, it was a very, very small sample size, but the Mets are confident that with Curtis Granderson out there in center field, Juan Magara spelling him late in games, and obviously starting against lefties, he still has that gold glove caliber defense that you can rely on. The Mets feel like they're okay in center. Now, the problem is just getting those corners settled down, and you've got Yoenis Cespedes in left, and right now you've got both Bruce and Michael Conforto in right field, and the Mets are confident in Michael Conforto. They still view him as a one of the brightest young offensive prospects in the game. So I think before the Mets report to spring training, certainly, and probably significantly before that, you're going to see a trade of Jay Bruce. And the question just is, what can they get in return? Can they get a live arm for the back end of the bullpen, or will they have to settle for prospects? We shall see. But I do think you're going to see a deal get done pretty soon.
So if we're reading between the lines, if we're just kind of parsing your words, you're telling me Jay Bruce for Andrew McCutchen straight up is not going to happen?
This is how rumors get started, Anthony. This is how rumors get started. No, I don't think you're going to see a Jay Bruce straight up for Andrew McCutchen trade as much as the Mets would probably say yes to that one.
I think they would say yes to that one. But, it doesn't seem like conditions are particularly ripe for a McCutchen trade. I don't love this Granderson proposal in center field, but, hey, not my club. That's the beauty of it. So we'll see how that works out. How about let's talk about the bullpen a little bit in light of the Jeurys Familia situation, waiting on word of whether or not he'll be suspended by MLB. But it sounds like they're not lining up backup plans from the outside for that one. It sounds like in the event that Familia is suspended, Addison Reed will close, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And the only thing we don't know at this point is, will Jeurys Familia be suspended? If he is suspended, how long? There's some precedent out there from the Jose Reyes case, from the Aroldis Chapman case, and it's all speculation at this point, but you might be looking at around a month, maybe a little less, maybe a little more. But it almost doesn't matter from the Mets' perspective, because they didn't go out and sign an Aroldis Chapman or a Mark Melanson or a Kenley Jansen, and those are the three big guys out there. They said, we're going to rely pretty much on what we have, and what they have is Addison Reed, who, you know, if you dig into the statistics, probably had a better year in 2016 than even Familia did. So he's going to close. He's got closing experience with the White Sox, with the Diamondbacks, and there's no issue there. The issue is more, how do the Mets now fill in behind Reed, particularly if they're missing Familia in April? They're going to go out, and they're probably going to sign an arm or two, and it might not be a huge name. You might be looking at kind of that middle of the pack. There's been plenty of talk about re-signing Fernando Salas, who was pretty good for the Mets down the stretch last year. There's been talk about re-signing a lefty specialist such as Jerry Blevins, who might be priced out of their range given how wild the market has gone for lefties out there. There are various ways the Mets can go. There are lots of mid-tier relievers out there that they can pursue. You know, I think the most interesting aspect of this is the Mets are going to come to camp with 7 starting pitchers. And among those are Zach Wheeler, who hasn't pitched in 2 years, Robert Gsellman, who was really, really good down the stretch, Seth Lugo, who was really, really good down the stretch. And it would not be surprising at all to see one or even two of those guys make their way into the Mets opening day bullpen, spell some other people while Familia is suspended, if he is, and wind up shoring the whole thing up a little bit. Sandy Alderson likes to build his bullpens from within. And I don't think this is any exception that the Mets are going to look to do that in 2017.
Another area of potential instability when you look at the Mets depth chart is that catcher, just given the way things went in 2016 for Travis d'Arnaud, basically bypassed late in the season for in favor of Rene Rivera. But it's obviously one of those where they're just hoping on better health and better things for d'Arnaud in 2017.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And the Mets could have gone out and signed a Matt Wieters or even a Wilson Ramos, who might not be ready for opening day. And they decided not to. And I remember Sandy Alderson was asked earlier this offseason, do you expect to improve at catcher? And the implication was, do you expect to go out and sign someone? But Alderson's response was, yeah, we expect Travis d'Arnaud to be much, much better. You know, the Mets went out and they signed the new third base coach in Glenn Sherlock, a longtime Arizona Diamondback who has a reputation for helping catchers. He was a catcher himself professionally, and the Mets are pretty hopeful that with him working with Travis d'Arnaud, and they're already working actually out in Arizona this offseason, with him working with Travis d'Arnaud on his defense, it'll clear his mind a little bit to focus on the offense. And I do think what people forget about d'Arnaud is that he's not that far removed from being a very productive big leaguer. Down the stretch in 2015 into the playoffs in 2015, he was really, really good. And the issue has been more, with the exception of last summer, has been more staying healthy than being productive when healthy. If Travis d'Arnaud can stay healthy, the Mets are pretty confident that he will bounce back and he will have a good season. And You know, they have some depth there now. They have Rene Rivera, who they like a lot. They see him as a backup and nothing more. But that's a pretty nice backup to have. He performed well, controlled the running game last year, all the things you like to see from a backup veteran with a little leadership. So the Mets do have that measure of depth, but this one's on Darnell. This one's all on Travis Darnell, and can he be finally now at age 27 kind of what this team has expected him to be for 4 or 5 years now, which is really a star at the position, one of the better offensive catchers in the game, and the type of guy that makes your lineup just that much deeper.
All right, there you have it. The latest word from Anthony DeComo as we head into 2017, and the Mets look to get back to October stage for the third straight year. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. It's been MLB.com Extras, New York Mets edition. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Katchevince, and this is our latest look at the Miami Marlins. I'm joined by Joe Fusaro. Joe, it's been an active winter already on the Marlins front. They didn't necessarily get the guys they wanted to get in the back end of the bullpen. I'm talking about the top end of the free agent market was represented by Aroldis Chapman, Kenley Jansen. But I think they did pretty well in beefing up that bullpen all the same. Junichi Tozawa and Brad Ziegler both come along in two-year deals. They also re-signed Dustin McGowan. So it just seems like that mindset makes sense where, look, we have this, you know, we lose Jose Fernandez to, you know, just tragic circumstances. It's a hole that you just can't fill. And fundamentally, the starting rotation is difficult to fill anyway in this particular market. So we're going to build up our bullpen as best we can, take some of the pressure off the starters. It's a tack that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, Anthony, I think this kind of look, if you kind of look at it as a draft, if you look at this free agency period this year, and you look at it, let's say, a typical June draft, what is the strength of that draft? Well, the strength of this free agency was bullpen depth. The Marlins happened to have what they felt was a strength being their bullpen. So rather than try to force a need and overspend on a pitcher or starting pitcher, they just kind of tapped into that market and tried to create assets and value and depth. And, you know, they used the word super bullpen was kind of their focus. And obviously, you know, the dollars were enormous and the commitment to a Jansen and the Chapman. But, you know, you get either of those two and your bullpen immediately is super. Now, so they fall short there. But to get Brad Ziegler, to get Junichi Tozawa, you know, two veteran guys, to re-sign McGowan, who had 54 appearances, you know, you got three guys returning, veteran guys, that filter in with A.J. Ramos, who will be back closing most of the time, David Phelps, who really established himself in the back end of the bullpen, although he could do everything, and Kyle Barraclough, who's kind of an unsung guy who people are starting to know more and more. You know, now you got six really good quality arms. They happen to all be right-handed, and I think you might look at it entirely right-handed bullpen, but I don't think that matters to them because, again, that was the strength of it, and these guys, if they're good enough, they could get lefties out as well. This also, by creating this this depth, you got guys like Nick Whitgren, Brian Ellington, you know, some of their young guys that they already have in their system or had even got big league time who add depth, and they're going to need that. As you noted, this is not, you know, going to be the deepest or the strongest rotation. So they figured, let's kind of shorten games as much as we can. We have numbers back there that we could go 7, 8, 9, 10 deep because they got some young guys also that could be, you know, coming up, you know, from the minors to join this and just try to do the best we can to navigate the back end of games and win them. Another thing to keep in mind, Anthony, last year the Marlins in save opportunities had 84. That was by far the most in the majors. They had 84 save chances, opportunities. The second on that list was the Seattle Mariners with 74. The Marlins converted 55 of those saves. So that's 29 games that potentially got away from them. They finished through all the tragedy at the end of the year. They still finished 3 under. For the most of the year, they were over. You know, what if they, you know, improved that by 10? They might have been in the playoffs. So, you know, the best case for them is to get as strong a bullpen as possible. Obviously, the everyday lineup is going to have to be key to stay healthy, and then, you know, not sustain serious blows there. But they feel they play very good defense. They got a good everyday lineup. If their rotation is, you know, what they stress there, with guys that with a history of at least throwing innings, and you know, getting Edison Volquez, who had, I think, 189 last year. You know, you've got guys that have a history of going 170 or more innings that, look, we're going to have a bunch of threes, but, you know, we're going to go as deep as we can, and we're going to back them up with some really quality guys in the bullpen.
Yeah, you mentioned Volquez came aboard, Jeff Locke as well. What are the chances they make another addition to that starting staff here in the new year? Anything brewing on that front?
Everything seems to be kind of quiet there, but I think they're going to wait and see what the market kind of does. As of now, they seem content to go, which is funny because they have no lefties in the bullpen, but they have three lefties in their rotation right now. With, you know, Adam Connolly, who's probably the most talented starting pitcher, and Wei-Yin Chen, the most established in terms of having at least a 4 or so year period when those good years he had in Baltimore. And then, as you noted, Jeff Locke, who they got early into winter meetings from formerly with the Pirates. So, you know, those are kind of the guys. And then you got Volquez, who has, you know, a ring a couple of years ago with the Royals, and has a history of, you know, being kind of a workhorse. And Tom Kohler, you know, an unsung homegrown guy for the Marlins who goes 170 or more innings every season as well and goes 30 starts. So could they do something? Yes, I don't think it's going to be anything large, though. I mean, if Ivan Nova came down in his asking price, but I still think you're going to see, you know, a lot of competition for that. And I think the Marlins are going to look and say, really, are we really just going to go 30, 40 million for a number 4 or 5 starter? Well, let's just, you know, see if one of the guys we have in our system could be a 4 or 5 starter if we need depth. And they got a prospect named Luis Castillo, not to be confused with the former second baseman, you know, but this guy is a talented kid who's probably going to open the year at AAA. He was the AA pitcher of the year in the Southern League. And, you know, this guy's got some upside. And I think in June, you know, once that kind of service time period passes, and Castillo, if he's doing what he's been, you know, showing a bit as his track record, I wouldn't be shocked if that guy joined the rotation if there were a need at that point.
As far as the lineup, obviously pretty well set there, but do you see any moves for the bench between now and spring training?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're going to need a right-handed bat off the bench who could, you know, probably play first base and a corner outfield spot. You know, I think an interesting fit potentially would be a Mike Napoli, but I'm not getting a lot of vibe that that's where they want to go. But, you know, someone that could kind of help ease with Justin Bour at first. You know, Bour played in, I think, 90 games last year, missed significant time with an ankle injury. But when healthy, Bour is a guy capable of 25, 30 homers. But, you know, he pretty much is strictly going to face, you know, right-handed pitching. Hadn't shown a ton yet against lefties. So I think they're going to have to get that righty bat, probably someone who can knock the ball out of the park. You know, there are some free agents out there, and, you know, like everyone else, they're kind of waiting and see, you know, when that domino falls and if that just triggers all those, you know, first basemen, the Chris Carter types. It could also fit the mold as well.
All right, there you have it. The latest word from Joe Fusaro as we venture into 2017 and the Marlins look to get back to October. I want to thank Joe for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Miami Marlins edition. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Atlanta Braves. I'm joined by Mark Bowman. And, Mark, obviously it was a pretty active early hot stove season for the Braves. Coming off some serious strides in the second half of 2016, they sought to address their rotation. They did so in a fairly aggressive way with some quick signings of Bartolo Colon and R.A. Dickey to one-year deals. Acquired Jaime Garcia from the Cardinals. He's also under wraps for 1 year. So obviously, you know, short-term veteran variety, but it adds a lot of credibility to that rotation. I don't know if you want to call it the elephant in the room or what, but they're certainly the Braves were tied to some bigger names in the trade market. You know, Chris Sales, Jose Quintana, that sort of thing. Even John Coppola, Renee on our website, dropped the name of Chris Archer as what he wants for Christmas. But it doesn't seem like with where this club is at in its rebuild, to totally blow up the farm system for one of those guys doesn't seem to make a ton of sense, although sometimes, you know, things make more sense than they seem. What are your thoughts on the rotation as it stands today, and are there any chances of maybe a big name still joining this bunch before 2017 begins?
So when Coffey has his phone in his hand, there's always a chance. You know, this guy never stops, evaluating and, putting pieces together and say, well, does this make sense? Does that make sense? Because, you know, hey, look, the Chris Archer, the Chris Sale deal basically ended with this. I mean, the conversation was this. We want, the Braves have been looking at Chris Sale for 4 years. They called him back, said, look, it looks like he may be more available this year. What's it going to take? The White Sox said Dansby Swanson. The Braves said no. The Braves said, does he have to be involved? And they said yes. They said, what if we give you every other minor leaguer in our system? And the White Sox said no. So that's about how far the Sox progressed. For Chris Archer, obviously Coffey has made it known. There's still some interest. But from what I can tell, the Rays ask still hasn't neared the Braves' comfort zone. And I think the Braves have to look at what they have. It'd be nice to have Chris Archer in that contract. You know, it's one of the friendliest contracts in the game. But there's a potential that, to get Chris Archer, they might have to give up at least two Chris Archers. Their strength and their rebuild is through this depth, the amount of pitchers that they've compiled. You don't want to take away from that depth too much because you really don't know exactly who's going to hit. You look at that next wave. I mean, you've got Matt Whistler and Aaron Blair. You can't give up on them. You got a pretty good feel where Mike Foltynewicz is going. Now this next wave, you've got Sean Newcomb, Patrick Wiegel, Max Fried. You know, you're optimistic about all three. Well, we were really optimistic about Aaron Blair and Matt Whistler at this time last year. You know, maybe one of these guys hits. Maybe one doesn't. Then all of a sudden you got your next wave with the Allards and then some of the guys that even they drafted this past year on the way. So you don't want to take away from that depth just to go out and get a Chris Archer. You may have been tempted to do so for Chris Sale. I think I'm going to put Chris Sale in a different category than Chris Archer. I don't think that I'm going to get too much argument there. So maybe you take a risk there. But at the same time, I think they feel really good about where their rotation is. I think the one thing about the offseason that didn't necessarily surprise me, but at the same time, I still kind of question where they're going. You know, when they got rid of Roger McDowell, I think I made it pretty clear I didn't agree with the move. I thought it was short-sighted. I thought it was, a move to be more coddling to some of these younger players who couldn't take tough love. This is a guy who was, he's a pretty good, I think he's as good a coach as they've had, at any point in time since I've been covering this team. They said they didn't like the way he handled young pitching, and then they go out and get two 40-year-olds right off the bat. But as October went on, I did hear that Dickey and Cologne were probably their top two targets. So it really wasn't too surprising when they, got those two guys there in November. I think the most surprising part might have been that, Cologne was willing to leave New York, but at the same time, he's so close to, the most wins record by a Dominican Latin pitcher. He's got those records sitting right there in front of him. He wanted an opportunity to pitch, and he's obviously has that relationship that you've known about, for a long time there, back there in Cleveland with John Hart. So that helped. Jaime Garcia is a bit of a gamble in my mind. You look at his injury history, the Braves keep saying that, he's in a contract year, he's motivated. I think Mike Hampton was motivated. Sometimes your body just doesn't allow you to do things you want to do. But at the same time, they didn't give up a lot for him. They've shown their willingness to flip guys in the past. It's not necessarily as easy to flip a guy with a $12 million contract. But if he's pitching effectively, they're going to have to create some spots for, like I said, some of those young pitchers. You don't want to block their path. So if a Whistler, Blair, Newcomb, and Fried is ready in June or July, somewhere in that area, you do want to create a spot. So maybe you flip a Garcia or one of those other two guys, the two 40-year-olds.
Yeah, Garcia, a contract year, it's not a question of motivation. It's a question of ability. We always talk about contract years. I mean, there's always guys who have terrible contract years. It's just, the contract year is not the driving force. It's the conditions, your body, your ability, and whatnot. So another narrative we like, Mark, in this business is guys returning home or guys returning to their roots. But here's one I can't shake. Matt Wieters, I can't shake this one. I know what's been said publicly, but he's still lingering out there in the market. There's not a lot of great, obvious fits for him. He went to Georgia Tech, of course. Now, Tyler Flowers did put up good numbers last season, but do you think there's any possibility Weeters falls in this club's lap in the new year?
You know, this price is, you know, his price is probably going to have to fall far below expectations. You know, I get it. I understand why there's interest. But, I mean, as far back as July, August, when I was asking about Weeters, well, let me make this clear. I mean, obviously, at that point in time, Ramos had not suffered a knee injury, and he was more attractive. So, you know, I'll preface it by saying that. But let's, you know, even when I was saying, well, what about Weeters? You know, they're saying, look, he's, you know, he's over 30. You know, it's a big catcher like that. You just don't know exactly how he's going to continue to evolve over the next years. Can he stay healthy? He's had some injury history, obviously, himself. There's just really never been interest. At the same time, the longer he lingers out here on the free agent market, you know, I think the Braves have to at least do their due diligence and say, okay, at this price, does it make sense? But at the same time, if I had to put a percentage on him landing here, I'm still probably going to put it in between, you know, 5 to 10%, and that's probably being generous.
Yeah. All right, there you have it. The latest word from Mark Bowman, and we'll continue to check in with him throughout 2017 as the Braves move into a new ballpark and look to move up the NL East standings. I want to thank him for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Atlanta Braves edition. Hey, everybody, thanks for tuning in. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and this is our latest look at the Philadelphia Phillies. I'm joined by Todd Zalecki. And Todd, going into the new year in 2017, just before year's end in 2016, Phillies made a couple interesting moves. We'll start with Clay Buchholz coming aboard the rotation in a trade with the Red Sox. And, you know, the rotation's starting to shape up to be a real strength for this Phillies club, and now they add a, you know, a nice veteran presence there in Buchholz.
Yeah, I think what they're hoping here is kind of what's been their MO the entire offseason. Any veteran they acquire is either on a one-year contract or basically is on a one-year contract. And in the case of Buchholz, he's going to make $13.5 million next year then become a free agent. So much like Jeremy Hellickson, who's on a one-year $17.2 million contract, I think what they're hoping in both of those cases is both pitch very, very well, and they become very attractive trade pieces before the July 31st trade deadline. And you know, $13.5 million is a lot to pay for somebody like Buchholz who struggled last season in the rotation, although he did have a pretty decent month of September starting again. But, you know, for them, they have so much payroll flexibility. Quite honestly, they can afford to take this gamble, you know. So they can pay him $13.5 million. The pitch is great. They trade him maybe for a decent prospect or something like that. And if he struggles and he doesn't pitch well, they can always eat the money and then call up one of the many prospects that they'll have in AAA and AA ready.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense from that perspective. I don't think the Phillies were, you know, necessarily one of the first teams you thought about when you know, trading for a starting pitcher of this ilk, because it is such a weak market for starting pitching that, you know, Buchholz has value in a lot of places right now, frankly, even though he has been so up and down in his career. But what you just said makes a ton of sense. A guy that could potentially flip in a few months. And again, anytime you can have hopefully a stabilizing veteran presence in a predominantly young rotation, that's a good thing. So Buchholz he's had an enigmatic career, to say the least.
Yeah.
But he definitely finished strong at a point where it seemed like he was out of the Red Sox rotation for good. They ended up needing him very much down the stretch. So see what the future holds there. And then another prominent move towards the end of the year was Odubel Herrera signing a five-year, $30.5 million extension. There are two option years on top of that would bring the total value to $52 million. Not bad for a guy taken 2 years ago in the Rule 5 draft. Tell us about you know, the thought process behind this extension and just the faith in Herrera moving forward.
Yeah, you know, it came down to really the fact that, you know, he's been very productive offensively. He's a 280 to 300 plus hitter, has a little bit of speed, and they think he can get better. And also he's, you know, you look at any of the metrics, he grades out really well defensively in center field. And so the Phillies looked at it like, you know, this is a very club-friendly deal. Even if he doesn't get any better than he is, if this is the best Odubel Herrera will be, his numbers over his last 2 years, they think they're getting a tremendous, tremendous deal in the sense that in 2021, which would have been his first year following free agency, he's only going to make $10 million. So, and he, quite frankly, even if he would somehow take a step back and really struggle, it's not that much of a financial commitment to them that they can't afford to take it. So it gives them some financial stability, some cost certainty going forward. So now when they start hitting the free agent market, they know, okay, we know we have Herrera locked up through potentially the 2023 season. And even in that 2023 season, it's like $12.5 million. So, again, very, very affordable when you look at what other outfielders are getting right now. And when you look at, quite frankly, there were some utility players this year that signed for, you know, two-year $16 million contracts. And Herrera's average annual value on his deal is $6.1 million. So you look at that and you go, starting center fielder that can hit Gold Glove finalist this year. Average annual value $6.1 million, the length of this contract, versus, like I said, some utility players are getting $8 million, $6 million, $6.5 million. And for that reason, I think it's a really good deal for the Phillies, and it becomes ridiculously good deal for the Phillies if you can even improve offensively down the road.
And it feels like a pivot point of a sort. I mean, a year ago, we trade in a controllable player in Ken Giles for prospects, and not to say that, you know, they can't still do stuff of that nature, but you know, starting to identify the players who are the future here, you know, the cornerstone type players. And I don't know if that means other players like, you know, Michael Franco or Nola or Eichhoff or Velasquez are explored with extensions. But, I mean, these are the guys who are kind of going to be the backbone of the next contending Phillies team.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great point. And Herrera is the kind of the first chip to fall there. And you wonder if Michael Franco ends up putting together a nice season. He struggled a little bit last year, although he showed some power, that they're still super high on him. You know, they point out that he's, you know, 24 years old, and that was really his first full big league season. So they expect him to take a step forward next year. And if he does, I would think he could be the next guy. And you mentioned Eichhoff, Velasquez, Nola, all of those guys fit in their plan of young players to build around. And then, you know, supplement them with a veteran, either free agent or a veteran trade piece. But Herrera, yeah, I think he kind of is going to start getting that ball rolling a little bit. And, you know, like I mentioned, cost certainty, I think, for the Phillies is huge. You know, they got him at such a – I really think this is such a club-friendly deal that it almost is no risk to them. You know, I guess there's a risk in any long-term deal. But for a team like the Phillies, that – he is literally their only player signed beyond next season, so they can certainly afford to take the shot on him.
Yeah, we're kind of previewing 2017 here, and it's hard not to start thinking about 2018, frankly. Because, as you said, this has been the modus operandi here has been to really trade for Howie Kendrick and Pat Neshek. They signed Joaquin Benoit, they re-signed Andres Blanco, re-signed Jeremy Hellickson, trade for Buchholz now. And these are all short-term solutions that give them a ton of payroll flexibility, you know, after 2017 and just kind of looking ahead. And, you know, as they infiltrate these young guys into the lineup, I mean, this is a real sleeping giant financially when you think a year ahead from now and especially after 2018, that monster free agent class that's coming after 2018.
Yeah, you know, the Phillies definitely have their eye on that big free agent market in a couple of years. They're definitely they're going to have a ton of money to spend, and I think they're going to be very motivated to spend it. I think Phillies ownership is going to be very motivated to spend it. I don't think they're going to sit there and make some kind of half-hearted effort to sign somebody like, say, Bryce Harper. I think if Bryce Harper is available and the Phillies have a need, I think they're going to take a really hard run at him. And if it's not him, I think they're going to take really hard runs at any other top-of-the-line free agent. I talked to Phillies president Andy McPhail in September about maybe – attacking the free agent market this offseason. He said, we don't want to just sign a player that can marginally help this team. We want to sign real difference makers. And to me, that meant more of a Harper, a Manny Machado, you know, an ace type of pitcher. If, you know, somebody opts out of their contract, you know, Kershaw can do that in a couple of years. I think Johnny Cueto can do that after this season. You know, he was talking about those types of players and less so a player who, is a 20 home run, maybe an 80 RBI guy on a good year. They don't want to spend money on those guys. They want to spend money on the perennial all-star MVP candidate, Cy Young candidate types of guys. And with these moves that they've made this offseason, like we mentioned, they have no financial commitments other than Herrera beyond next season.
Yeah, going to be a fascinating team to watch. And even in 2017, kind of a sneaky good rotation shaping up here. So we'll see what the future holds for the Phillies. Todd Zielecki will be all over it for MLB.com. I want to thank him for joining us. Thanks for tuning in. This has been MLB.com Extras, Philadelphia Phillies edition.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.